Hello, hello, listener. How are you today? Welcome to this next episode on the Mindful Eating Clinic podcast, the next Mindful Meets. And today I am joined by Dana Chapman. Dana, say hello.
Hello, everybody.
She is. She's got the most delectable, what do I call them, chandelier gold earrings on, which I'm coveting from this side of the screen. Anyway, why have I got Dana on? Well, I've got Dana on because Dana is a nutritional therapist. Now, I've had nutritional therapists on before, and there are many fantastic ones out there. What really struck me about Dana is the work that she does and the specialism that she has in relation to mental health and mental health and the impact that the gut biome and that gut-brain axis can have on how we feel. Because I think we still really, aren't we, in the infancy, Dana, of accepting that actually what we eat and the state of our gut health can have any impact on how we feel.
I can't agree more. I think lots of people are not acknowledging or realizing that the gut and the brain are actually connected. And I love sharing the simple statistic that 80% of signals actually go from the gut to the brain, and it's only 20% that go from the brain to the gut. And that should highlight to people just how significant the gut is when it comes to our mental health.
And that's quite a big thing to try and sort of get our heads around, isn't it? Because geographically, that's actually quite a distance, isn't it?
It is. It is,
But
but
it
actually, when you look,
uses a particular nerve, doesn't it?
it
Tell us about
does.
that.
It does. So actually, when we're formed in utero, the gut and the brain separate from the same cell. Obviously, the brain goes up and the gut goes down, but they are infinitely connected by what we call the vagus nerve, which starts from the base of the brain and wanders throughout the body and attaches to a few different organs, but ends up attaching to the gut as well. And it's most of that signaling between the gut and the brain go through this vagus nerve.
And it's an interesting specialism. And I know that in nutritional therapy, some people don't specialize at all. Other people will specialize in other areas. So, what is it about this particular area of nutritional therapy that really captured you to want to work in it? And if it's a long story, then we'll be very happy to sit back and listen.
Fabulous. I've not always been a nutritional therapist, so I worked in the corporate world before becoming a nutritional therapist. I was in one of the big four consulting firms, actually. And when I started studying when I was still working at in the corporate world, so I was studying and I was working at the same time because it was a part-time degree that I was doing. And when I was transitioning out of the corporate world and into nutrition, mental health was being spoken about a lot more. So it was starting to come to the forefront within the corporate world. But nobody was talking about the one area that I knew had such a massive impact on our mental health, and that was the gut. So it was wonderful that in the corporate world, we were speaking about normalizing poor mental health, and we were starting to speak about talking therapies and bringing in some meditation and some yoga. And we know all of those things are important, but we weren't speaking about food. And we weren't speaking about the gut and the impact that the gut has on our mental health. And that's mental health in terms of depression and anxiety, but it's also in terms of cognitive function. And so I knew that there was a gap in the market there. And because I was still studying, I then chose to do my dissertation on the link between stress, gut health, and mental health, because this is what I was seeing in the corporate world. So I made it really difficult for myself to try bring three elements into a dissertation, but I was determined to do it. And it was just so fascinating to learn more about how stress impacts the whole picture, but how the gut and the brain are so connected, and how improving the gut health and gut microbiome had that positive effect on mental health, but also on cognitive function as well.
Talk to us a little bit more about that stress relationship then, because I'm thinking that one can have stress through external factors, which can then drive poor nutrition, and then vice versa. Poor nutrition can then mean that we're less able to deal with those external factors. So how would you sort of unpick that relationship for us?
Yeah, so it can be a vicious cycle, and there's two main ways that stress impacts the gut microbiome. The first one is that stress, when we are in our stress mode, digestion shuts down. And that in and of itself can affect the gut and the gut microbiome, because if digestion shuts down, A, you're not absorbing any of the nutrients from the food that you're eating, but you don't produce enough stomach acidity, so you may not then be able to break your food down. And that then can mean that the food ends up in the large intestine and can feed the non-beneficial bacteria. So stress has an impact in that way, that it affects digestion. But stress has a direct impact on the gut microbiome, actually, in that it kills off beneficial bacteria and it promotes the growth of non-beneficial bacteria. So it's those two ways where it can really impact gut health and the gut microbiome.
So it's a real double whammy then, isn't it?
And then
And
you say it
so
can be a vicious cycle, because if you are eating poorly, or if your body's not able to break down that food, you then don't have the nutrients, and that's an internal stress. And people, I think, don't often realize that internal stresses have as much impact on our bodies as those external ones.
And I think even for someone who wouldn't know that, just thinking about it, we know that if we're in a situation where we are anxious or nervous, many of us feel it in our stomach. Some of us might actually have symptoms, but we know that we just feel that churning. I mean, that's at a very low level, isn't it? So the evidence is there at a fairly sort of superficial level. What we're understanding now is actually, yes, you might just be feeling a few butterflies or a bit of churning in your stomach, but actually that's having a wider physical impact. So would one of the things be that you would recommend then is to try and, I mean, I know this is slightly naive, but to try and reduce stress on the one hand, but then also eat in a way that is going to help support stress. And if so, what we might be getting into a bit of detail here, but that's what these conversations are like for anybody who listens. What might that look like then?
One of the things that I love to recommend is breath work. So we are all stressed and we can't take the stress away, but what we're not doing is building in those stress relieving activities. And breath work, we know, can switch us from our fight and flight mode, which is our stress response, into our rest, digest, and repair, which is what we call the parasympathetic nervous system, or that repairing from the stress. So I often recommend, if you are going through a period of stress, try and incorporate breath work before each meal, so that at least you know that the meal you're eating, you will hopefully then be able to digest fully. And we also know that 5 minutes of breath work a day is beneficial for reducing stress in the body. So managing stress is a very difficult thing to do, but what we can do is build in those stress relieving activities. Walks out in nature are beneficial, as well as yoga, because you're bringing in that breath work and movement at the same time. So yes, that's one thing I often suggest to people. And what people don't often realize is anxiety is actually a stress on the body as well. So you might not have external stresses again, but one of those internal stresses can be anxiety. And then we also know that stress depletes certain nutrients that are essential for creating our neurotransmitters and helping us feel happy and helping us feel calm, such as those B vitamins or magnesium. So if people are stressed, I often recommend increasing those sorts of foods that give those sorts of nutrients in the diet. So things like nuts and seeds, which are high in both B vitamins and magnesium. And vitamin C is another nutrient that's really depleted in times of stress. So trying to fill up in the diet with those, I always like to say vitamin C comes from those red, blue, and purple fruits and vegetables. So your berries, your tomatoes, your red peppers. So I think eating a really nutritious diet in a time where you are stressed is not going to add to that vicious cycle that we were talking about earlier. And in that way, help reduce the impact that stress has on the body as well.
Yes. And I think that is quite challenging. I mean, quite a lot of my clients have their biggest eating issues at exactly those times when they are feeling stressed, when they're feeling a little more emotional, because they don't have the mind space to make the better nutritional choices. And then, of course, there's also thrown into this the relationship that many of them will have with foods that are treat foods or they believe make them feel better because they feel rewarded. But of course, that is not a treat for the body, those kinds of refined carbohydrate foods. But it's hard, isn't it? You know, and it's difficult to find the space, to find the discipline, I guess, to say, right, I'm feeling really rubbish, therefore I'm going to have the biggest rainbow salad, I'm going to have fish, and I'm going to have double portion of broccoli, and you know, all of these things, because that's, yeah, but I'm feeling really bad already. Do I really have to eat broccoli, as I really don't like it? You know, there's all of this other sort of conversation going on, isn't it? It's tricky. So I'm wondering how you go about trying to convince and educate people that there is a direct correlation between the fuel that's going in and the way the machine actually functions. How do you do that?
I lost you for a minute, so I don't know if I got the entirety of that question.
It's quite a long question, as
Oh,
they sometimes can be.
sorry.
Okay, let me try and summarize it. Apologies for the internet. This is what happens when you live in the middle of nowhere in beautiful Herefordshire,
Oh,
but you are
bless.
rather at the mercy of slightly troublesome Wi-Fi at times. So
Right.
apologies, listener. Basically, the question was that I think for many people, it's difficult to believe that there is a direct correlation between the food that you put in your body and the way that you feel. How do you convince people? How would you like to convince people, influence people to make better decisions and to trust the fact that they will feel better?
Really great question. And I always like saying knowledge is power. So I think if we understand how our bodies work, we therefore can understand what we need to do to get our bodies to work optimally. And that's what we're all striving for, right? We all want to be functioning at that optimal level. So I think there's two education points here. One being when you are low, when you are emotional, when you are stressed, your body is producing more cortisol if you are stressed. Cortisol is made from cholesterol. So your body is saying, give me more cholesterol because you need to survive. I need to produce more cortisol. And that's often why we go out seeking those foods. I always like to say it's foods beginning with C and ending in E because they're high in cholesterol. So think about cheese, cake, chocolate, coffee, all those things that in the short term might make us feel better. And that will give us that cholesterol so that we can produce more cortisol. But the other element to it is when we eat foods that are high in carbohydrates, we get a very short and sweet serotonin boost from that. If we eat chocolate, we often get that dopamine hit, that reward center, like you mentioned earlier. So when you're feeling low and when you're feeling stressed and down, hopefully knowing that that's what your body is doing and that's why you might be craving those foods may help you to say, hang on, I can also get cholesterol from a massive bowl of salad with some olive oil and avocado and salmon. And at the same time, I'm giving my body nutrients to be able to create that serotonin. So serotonin is a happy hormone. Dopamine is that reward center. So eating those foods that are more beneficial for your body to have the raw materials to be able to create things like our neurotransmitters, those happy hormones. So that's the one side of it, is knowledge about, okay, I might be craving these foods because this is how I feel, but I know that the effects from those foods physiologically are both short term and long term. So short term, you might feel good, but long term, it's not doing any benefit to the body and in some ways can actually be detrimental. And I always love a saying by a nutritional psychiatrist, and he says, every time you eat, you can look at the food and go, is this food going to heal me? Or is it going to hurt me long term? And I'm not saying that we have to be perfect all the time because life is for living and enjoying food as well. But we want to be able to enjoy life. And eating foods that's going to help us enjoy life will be beneficial for us now and in the long term as well.
Yes, because we don't have the ability to know what lays ahead for us health-wise. But at least we can put some effort into the things that we can control now, which may mean that we are healthier for longer. But I guess it may also mean that if we're unlucky enough to have something diagnosed, we may be in a better condition to be able to withstand or recover from whatever treatment is required
Agreed.
to try and combat that diagnosis. That's what I always think. You know, it's an investment, isn't it? And we invest in so many other things. Why would we not invest,
In our health.
in the most important thing, you know,
I agree.
in our health and particularly our mental health. So you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that you were in the corporate world. I can't imagine that you just suddenly were working for one of the leading consultancies and thought, I know, I want to change a career. I'm going to be trained to become a nutrition. Well, it may have happened like that, but I don't think it did.
No.
So tell us a little bit about your story and how you ended up doing this wonderful work that you do.
Yeah. My interest in health and nutrition actually started as a teenager. I played a lot of sports. I was playing hockey 6 days a week at one point, but I was chubby and I was unhappy. And I had been around people who had yo-yo dieted. And I knew that the whole I'm going to eat 7 units or 8 units or 9 units a day or starve myself, because that's what the diets are, was not sustainable. I would not be able to perform on the hockey field, on being starved. And so I started reading up about how to become healthy. because I thought if I become healthy, then just maybe I'll lose some weight and I'll feel a bit better. And when I started reading up about how to become healthy, I was just amazed that you could eat certain foods and they would help in producing energy in the body. And I was like, wow, okay, well, I play hockey 6 days a week. Let's start eating the foods that are going to help me create energy within my body. And then I read, oh, you could eat certain foods that would be really beneficial for skin health. And so I started reading up about what foods could be good for skin health, because every teenager knows that your skin isn't the best in your teenage years. And so I was just so fascinated that you could eat certain foods and they would have all of these amazing effects in the body, but on the mind as well. When I was doing my A levels, I remember reading up about how I could be, how I could improve my cognitive function. And I started taking omega-3 capsules, and I profoundly noticed the difference between taking them and not taking them. And I grew up in Africa, so oily fish was not a thing that we would eat on a weekly basis, because we just didn't, it's just not one of the things that you have on offer there. And so that's where the passion for health and well-being started. But my first university career was in accounting and finance, and then I got a job in the consulting world. And so I continued on that path because at that stage, I was reading all the health magazines that I could get, and I was so absorbed in them. I absolutely loved it. And I thought, maybe I could just study this and it could be my job. But I couldn't put my parents through another 4 years of university. And so I thought, okay, well, maybe one day I will go back and study it. And when I moved back to the UK in 2013, so I had moved here in 2009, back to South Africa for a little while, and then back to the UK in 2013, I met a nutritional therapist, and she told me that she studied part-time. And so I was like, right, where did you study? What did you do? I got all the information I needed. And within 2 weeks, I had signed up. I had to do A-level biology and chemistry to be able to get into the degree. And then, I signed up and started studying in 2014. And
Wow.
the rest is sort of history. I did have two children in amongst my studies as well, so I
You
didn't
just
make life.
casually drop those in. Yes. Okay.
But this is what happens when it's a passion. And I suppose my maternity leaves were so completely different to everybody else in my NCT group. And they all used to say, how on earth do you go home and study? But it's when something excites you so much, when you love it so much, it's not difficult after a long day with a baby to sit down and study something where you're understanding how the body works. I mean, how amazing is it? And that's one of the key pieces of information that I think most people in the general public don't know. We don't know how our bodies function and how food interacts with that and how we can get our bodies to function better. So that's one of the messages I'm trying to share with the work that I do.
Yes. And at least nowadays, there is a lot more conversation, isn't there, about the gut biome? I mean, 5 years ago, who on earth had even heard of it unless you were in the industry, really? But I suppose with the advent of things like the ZOE program, where there's a huge emphasis on gut, I guess those things can only be good in terms of awareness, would you say?
Yes, I think it's amazing for awareness, and it's bringing about that awareness of what I eat has an impact on my gut microbiome. I mean, they measure blood glucose levels as well, which is another amazing indicator and really supportive of long-term health. But the main theory behind it is, how can you feed your gut microbiome so that you can get all of these health benefits that we get from a healthy gut microbiome?
Yes. So what would be your top three then? Not to take away any potential clients from you, but what would be your top three? How do Okay, so I'm going to sit in front of you and I'm saying, right, Dana, I've got a train to catch. How can I feed my gut biome?
I always say one of them is surprising, but the first one I always say is make sure that when you eat, your body is in a state to digest your food sufficiently. Always. So my first tip is always stop, smell, and breathe, because that's what starts your digestion process. The second one is I love the use of kefir, and I use a company. Can I name names? I use a company called Chuckling Goat Kefir. So it's based on goat milk. And kefir, the reason I suggest it is because it's full of pre and probiotics. So prebiotics feed the gut microbiome, and probiotics inoculate the gut with that bacteria and change the landscape of bacteria. So kefir would be my second one. And the third one that I love to suggest is cooked and cooled carbohydrates. So
Ah, resistant starch we're going to
resistant
talk about.
starch.
Yes, interesting.
So a lot of people eat rice, lots of people eat potatoes, lots of people eat pasta. But if you want to eat those foods in a way that's A, going to support your blood sugar levels, but B, also support your gut microbiome, cook them, cool them for 24 hours. And then you can reheat them again, or you can eat them cold. And in that way, you're feeding the bacteria in your gut microbiome. So what happens is that cooking and cooling process changes the structure of the carbohydrate such that it passes through the digestive system undigested. That's why you don't get the blood sugar spike from it, but it lands up in your large intestine and acts as food for your gut bacteria. So they feed off it and thrive. So I think those would be my top three.
Great. Well, thank you. How interesting. Yes, because people listening might be thinking, oh, here we go, fiber. Here we go, fiber all day. I mean, fiber's still great, isn't it?
Important. Yeah.
But it's interesting that it's not in your top three. And I particularly like the first one because in the work that I do with my clients, I talk a lot about creating a mindful eating setting so that it's as slow as possible, that it's apart from distractions, that it's focused, that you've got the ability to allow your fullness hormone to really work so that you know when you've had enough. And you can't do that if you're, racing, and to actually savor, to actually start to enjoy it. And I picked up on something that you posted on LinkedIn about getting the joy back into eating and cooking and preparing food. So, a little bit about why that's also important to you.
I think because we eat three times a day. And again, just to reiterate what I was saying earlier, you can eat and heal your body and provide nutrients, or you can just eat for enjoyment purposes. And the reason why I think we should get the joy back into cooking is because that whole process of cooking actually starts the digestion process. That smelling of the food, that seeing the food, that handling the food is indicating to your body that we should start that digestion process. We should start creating that stomach acid and those pancreatic enzymes to get you ready to start digesting your food.
It can also
And
be a lovely mindful experience, can't it? So I have quite a lot of clients who will say, oh, it's hopeless when I start cooking. I just start eating it. I just start picking and I'm thinking about this, thinking about that. And I will say, well, can you actually really focus, really laser in on what you're doing? And one exercise that we do is I talk about what's on the menu later for them. And say they have to chop some onions. I go, right, okay. So I want you to do it slowly. I mean, don't cut yourself or anything. Do it quite slowly. And I want you to focus on the feel of the knife going through it, the sound. When can you start to smell the onion? And how does that change as it becomes more intense? Because when you're focusing like that, your brain is not then thinking, oh, I'll just have a chocolate biscuit while I do this onion, you know. And so those two go beautifully hand in hand, don't they? So we're creating this lovely platform for the physical side of things, but also the psychology is creating this relaxed environment as well, and also distracting us from cooking or feeling too sort of frenzied. And often that frenzy around cooking, around being late, or you know, or thinking that we're late, drives the eating, because the unhelpful eating is a distraction from that frenzied activity. So we need a lovely sort of tranquil bubble around it, don't we?
We do, and I think that's so key. And like you say, so many people can get distracted and can find it a really stressful experience. I know not everybody loves cooking, but choose something simple then that you know you enjoy cooking, that you know you enjoy eating, and focus on the end goal. Focus on the delicious meal that you're going to be feeding your body and mind with. And choose something that's sustainable for you. So if it is a piece of salmon that takes 5 minutes to cook with a salad that takes 3 minutes to prepare, it doesn't take a long time, does it? So it
No.
doesn't need to be this extravagant thing. But and in that way, you can also control what you're eating. If you're buying food in, you don't have much control over the quality of the ingredients that you're eating.
I have a question that's popped into my head that I'm imagining might be being posed by our listener. What about the risks of reheating rice?
Love this one.
Would you like to tell us how to do it safely?
So I think the recommendation is always 2 minutes. So if you've cooled rice down, putting it back in, I don't have a microwave at home. So if you have a microwave, 2 minutes in the microwave will do. But if you have a saucepan, I pop it in the saucepan, add a tiny bit of water, and bring that water to a boil so that it steams through the rice for about 2 minutes. So you're heating the rice back up to a certain temperature, so that might kill off any non-beneficial bacteria that has grown in the rice.
Yes, perfect. And the other thing that came to my mind was when we were talking about improving the gut biome, and I think there was a little bit of a backlash. I don't know if it was directly against Zoe, so I'm not putting that out there at all. But I think just the idea that if we are clinically depressed, that eating food which is going to improve our gut biome is not an alternative to medication. And I think possibly some of the posts and some of the sort of thoughts that were out there were taken a little bit out of context, actually, you know, when they were challenged. So I just wonder if you have a take on that subject.
Yeah, I think clinical depression needs to have psychiatric evaluations. And if you are on medication, never to take yourself off, but to always speak with your GP. If ever I am working with people with depression and they are on medication, I never ever advise going off that medication. But medication doesn't work for everyone. So using diet and supporting the gut microbiome are ways to improve mental health. And there was a wonderful study called the SMILES trial, which I often refer to, where individuals were put on a Mediterranean style diet for 12 weeks. And it wasn't fresh fruit and vegetables, in fact, it was tinned and frozen fruit and vegetables that were used because they wanted to make it, they wanted to measure the cost of the basket between a normal week's worth of groceries and a week worth of groceries following a Mediterranean style diet. And the Mediterranean style diet actually came out slightly cheaper than the normal weekly shop. But yeah, people were put on this Mediterranean style diet for 12 weeks. I believe most of them were on medication, actually. And 30% of the people on the study reached remission at the end of the study. But nowhere in the study does it say that they went off their medication then. That is always something that needs to be discussed with a doctor or a psychiatrist. Does that
Oh,
answer your question?
interesting. Yeah, yes, it does. Yes, I'm kind of thinking about I'll put a link perhaps to
The SMILES
that
trial.
trial. Maybe it's on the pub, maybe
It is on
website.
PubMed. It is a freely available resource. And there have been a number of other studies as well using the Mediterranean style diet in mental health. And it's because of all of the nutrients in the Mediterranean style diet. You've got oily fish in there for your omega-3s. You've got grains for B vitamins. You've got animal products, again, for B vitamins. Nuts and seeds were included, and olive oil as well. Olive oil is one of the really great for the gut microbiome. It's full of what we call polyphenols, which help feed the gut microbiome. So loads of ways in which the Mediterranean style diet is useful in poor mental health conditions.
Yes. I'm wondering whether it was slightly cheaper because there was possibly less red meat in it, maybe the basket.
Potentially. So I think red meat might have been once a week, but maybe it was because of the inclusion of beans and lentils. Perhaps it was because of the inclusion of frozen fruit and vegetables because they are potentially cheaper.
And I think that's something to really hit home, isn't it? That actually, if it's the choice between broccoli that's limping towards you from the back of the fridge and has been there for about a week, and frozen broccoli, then you're better having frozen, I think. Yes,
Agree.
because it's been picked and plunged straight in that green bag very, very quickly. So I'm glad that we got the clinical depression thing out there because I think sometimes people will maybe ask that question. But in terms of if we're just feeling low, stressed, overwhelmed, we just find that our emotions are sort of heightened and we don't feel as able to cope with life in general as we normally do. I'm going to go back to the beginning, really, and just ask you to really reiterate and impress upon anyone that's feeling like this that their diet can very easily be the answer.
It can be the cause and the answer. Because our bodies don't work by magic, although they do work by magic, but when you have magic, you have ingredients to make the magic work. And the ingredients to make the magic work in our bodies is nutrients from the food that we're eating.
Yes. And many of the listeners will know that I'm a very keen gardener. I've just planted some seeds for winter salad in my greenhouse. Now, I have a choice, don't I? I have a choice between getting absolutely the right seed compost, which has the right level of nutrients, not too much, not too little, or I can just go out and dig up some turf and just plonk a bit of soil in there. It's going to have an impact on the crop that I get. And it's exactly the same, isn't it? It's about those, I think you called it raw materials when we're having our little chat before we actually came on air today. It is about those raw materials. And if we also refer back to that chat that we had around breath work and yoga and all those things that help, that's like tending the flower, say, so, or tending the tomatoes and kind of making sure, perhaps that they're fed and watered and they're tidied up nicely. But if they're not in the right soil to start with, you're just kind of playing about on the surface, really, potentially.
Yeah, and that's what the gut microbiome can be related to, right? The soil that your plants are growing in. And unbeknownst to us, you could have a gut microbiome that is not giving you all the benefits that it should. And that could be for a whole host of reasons. The gut microbiome is affected by antibiotic use. It's affected by mode of birth, how you came into the world. It's affected by age, and it's affected by the food that we eat. And like I said earlier, it's affected by stress as well. So,
Yes.
really nurturing our gut microbiome is a way to support our overall health.
And if there's someone out there thinking, well, I'm doing all these things, I don't really know what it's like. I don't really know if it's great or if actually what I think I'm eating is really having the impact that I hope that it's having. What can they do to be a little bit more informed?
So you can tap into symptoms if you have symptoms of poor gut health, such as brain fog, poor skin, joint aches and pains, poor digestion, so acid reflux, bloating, gas, not passing stool frequently enough, passing stool too frequently. Those are all symptoms that your gut microbiome might be out of whack. But you can do testing as well. So in clinic, I do functional, I'm trying to change it to say functional gut testing because it sounds a little bit better than functional stool testing, which is actually what it is.
It's P double O, friends. It's P double O. Well,
But
of
there's so
course it
much that
is,
you can
because
tell from
that's the
P00.
evidence, isn't it?
Yeah, it
Yeah.
is. It is actually. And we don't talk about it enough. We don't look at our own poo enough to know what's going on in the inside. And so testing can be a really nice way to understand what's really going on underneath the bonnet, so to say.
Absolutely. And then you in your practice would then look at what that says, look at other symptoms, and then be able to recommend what might need to change. I'm going to put a link to you, obviously, in the blurb. But wow, well, we've packed loads in, and the time has really, really flown. There's so much there, isn't there? But it doesn't have to be a massive overhaul of absolutely everything. As you said earlier, we don't have to be perfect. I mean, what sort of ratio would you think is a good ratio in terms of positive, healthy nutrition and actually just going with the flow? Because, as you say, life is meant for living and food should be a joy. And sometimes that does mean a slightly less nutritious choice. What would you say?
Absolutely. I love the 80-20 rule. And that's if you've got good health, though. If you don't have good health, I think start off with more of like a 90-10. But 80-20 is a nice balance to say 80% of the time you're feeding your body with the nutrients that it needs to perform the functions that it needs to perform. And then 20% of that time, go and have that ice cream or pizza on a Friday night with the girls or because meals eaten in that environment are still so beneficial for your body because you're getting that social aspect to it as well. So I like the 80-20 rule.
Yes, thank you. And of course, also, if we are in that lovely social environment, we're going to be nice and relaxed. There's a nice sort of nice level bed of compost for everything to land in and go, oh, this is nice. I've got the right kind of level of moisture. Actually, talking about moisture, we haven't discussed alcohol, and I feel like we should give it a little bit of airtime before we draw it to a close.
I went for a blood test this morning and they swabbed my arm with alcohol, and they do that to kill off bacteria. So alcohol is not beneficial for gut health or the gut microbiome. And that's not to say you can't enjoy a drink every now and again, but if alcohol is part of your diet on a daily basis, you are not benefiting your gut microbiome.
There we are. You've heard it here. It's a choice, as with all these things. It's a choice, isn't it? And it's an investment in what's happening and a real understanding that we have the control, no matter what budget we're on, because as we've said, frozen stuff, tin stuff, I mean, tin pulses have got to be one of the cheapest superfoods on the planet, haven't they?
Agreed.
So, oh, Dana, so much to, and you said process. We don't want that word anywhere near our discussion, do we? Well, not ultra process anyway. But yeah, some fantastic information and tips for us to really think more about what we put in and how we can feel. We can genuinely 100% feel better if we get the raw materials right. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laurie. I've really, really enjoyed our talk.
It's absolutely smashing. So I will put all the links in. I'll put the links to that Smiles trial as well, if you'd like to investigate a little bit more about that, and how you can get in touch with Dana if you want to explore, in fact, what kind of a state your gut biome is in, particularly if you have any symptoms. Why not? It's never too late either to do something about not feeling as good as you potentially could. So, my thanks to Dana, my thanks to you for listening. We're into the 60s now with episodes. So, if you've gone straight in with this, you can go backwards. There are lots of conversations, and everyone who comes on has a story and somehow has something to do with the thinking, the mind, the mindfulness, the being mindful, understanding, being aware of something. So there's a, yeah, I know sometimes it's a bit tenuous, but they're also interesting. It doesn't really matter, does it? So I look forward to having you listen next time. And for today, from Dana and myself, thank you very much.